Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome all, of course, our visitors from overseas, and I hope at some point you'll be able to get a hot shower before you leave. possibly a steak. Things look pretty grim. My talk is a local contribution. I'm out at Monash University, which is not visible on that slide, but anyway, I might dim those lights down a bit, Matthew, so we can see Monash. That's much better. Yes. So for about 25 years I've been looking at an idea of how the solar system formed, and my work has sort of tried to keep parallel with the activities in space as well, because the theory is fairly controversial, so I'm always keen to have a space probe go up there and see if any of it sort of bears weight. And so the theory I've been looking at is a sort of invention of Laplace's model, but let's move on. What I'll do is I'll press this, FWD, that's right. Before, about 25 years ago, we had no spacecraft up there at all, and all the best we could do was a sort of artist's impression. This is about early 72, I think, and that's all we knew of the solar system. And really, it's because of these unmanned space missions, mostly due to the NASA through the Jet Propulsion Lab, that really has just increased our knowledge of the solar system and the world immeasurably, and to the extent that we really, as Bob said, we have now have a space probe past every object except major object except Pluto, and he's right there, except I have cheated and I have squeezed in Pluto here. But it's not as a result of the Australian space program that we can proudly bring you that image, nor is it a photographic flaw, but it's just been added to the picture. But closer up there, those inner chaps, you can see it's amazing, you know, the scale, from comparing those two, the scale of the solar system, and it's only through these spacecraft that we've actually seen so much. And Tuesday night, Ed Stone's going to give a public lecture at Melbourne Uni. I've got some flyers for that, about Mars and the search for life elsewhere. That's a free public lecture up at Melbourne Uni. And, of course, the outer solar system, it was Stone who was had the place of Bob there. He was actually, Stone was the project scientist, I think, for the whole Voyager mission, which started back way back in 77. And that really produced an enormous bounty of information about our solar system, and as Bob showed, the size of Jupiter is enormous. It completely dwarfs its moons, and there are many parallels between the Jupiter system and its family of planets, or moons, almost planet-sized moons, and of course the Sun in that respect. They're really the two systems. One's just a scaled-down version of the other, and whatever processes are responsible for the formation of the planetary system almost certainly occurred as well at Jupiter. And also, possibly even Saturn, and it's a great... I didn't realise that Bob, of course, he's also wears two hats, and he's also the project manager, I believe, for the Cassini mission, and this was one of the last of our views from Voyager back in 81. Again, showing how huge the Saturn system is compared to its moons. They're really just little pipsqueaks, and it's extraordinary that that planet was able to spawn such small fellows. They obviously needed more nourishing at the time. This one, I think Bob has shown, I won't go into that anymore, but it just shows that these moons are almost planet size. I think even larger than Mercury, I think one of them is. Speaking of Mercury, that's the densest planet in the solar system, and I'm interested in how the planet's formed, and the chemistry is a very important indicator of the temperatures and things around the time. Little Mercury stands heads and shoulders above the others in the density stakes. These are uncompressed densities. You've got to take away the effects of self-gravity. It must be mostly made of iron, and compared to Venus and Earth, which have got more greater quantities of silicates. So the chemistry of the solar system tells us an awful lot about the conditions which were there at the beginning. But about 200 years ago, well, because we didn't have these spacecraft and stuff, all we knew really about the orbits of the planets, and even 200 years ago, I think the planet Uranus was only barely discovered, and there's Pluto again sporting itself. It has an inclined plane. It's really not, it's a minor planet, and some people believe it may have even either been an escape moon of Neptune, or possibly even once existed in the same orbit of Neptune and had a very close encounter. But there's no doubt about it, the planets are all coplanar, and this suggested they did somehow form from a common cloud. and possibly due to rotation. And the idea I've been looking at is a working of Laplace's nebula hypothesis, where we have a contracting cloud, but I go a little further and with Laplace and suggest, because he's not here today, he died 200 years ago, but that the primitive sun shed gas rings, unique little spinning gas rings, and the planets condensed one by one from each of these. And there's a lot of argument in favour of that. By the way, that is Laplace there, just a portrait. And here are his sort of helpers, because he just didn't do it all on his own. He really integrated the work that had gone before. And I think that's the secret. You really got to learn by what's other people's mistakes and other and things around you as well. And, of course, Newton's was a great... He took advantage of Newton's work. But it's interesting because Mercury, I mentioned a moment ago, we saw how small Saturn's moons were. Saturn, and you can see here in this slide, it's actually a... Ian Sullivan from the Victorian Astronomical Society took several years ago as a passage of Mercury across the face of the Sun, and a transit, quite rare. And it just shows how small, not as rare as the Venus ones though, but you can see that little blip there. Just goes to show how small these planets are compared to the parent. Well, Laplace's theory was thrown out because it was very hard to see how one of these great contracting clouds could get rid of all its what we call its excess spin or angular momentum it inherited from the formation of the galaxy. If it got rid of all its spin, it would have got rid of all its mass, and you'd expect to see monster planets and very little at the centre. And that's what unfortunately caused Laplace's theory to be thrown out. But genes. He, in the early part of this century, there was a whole rash of alternative theories and wandering stars and things like that. But I think one thing that's come out of this space exploration program, and as Bob said, the close parallels between the two systems means that planet formation really must be very common, not only within our own solar system, but elsewhere as well, almost certainly. We're seeing planets around other stars. So there's a movement away, the random theories. I think most people would agree that somehow or other the Sun, by processes which aren't fully understood, did contract as a great cloud, and it did either shed a disk or, in my case, a family of rings. I'll tell you more why I favour rings. But the actual physical mechanisms by which this happened are still being sort of eked out. And that's where the Hubble Space Telescope and other studies of interstellar clouds are so important, because they're showing us the sort of processes that are attendant to the early stages of star formation. And obviously the galaxy out there, and this is within our own galaxy, there's a lot of energy there, these nebulae, these are called twisters, a huge amount of energy inside there, and gravitational energy as clouds contract, and great pillars of gas, and it's believed within these great pillars of huge size there that somehow planets are forming, or stars are forming within these guys. And they do see evidence of isolated disks, but it's hard to actually see inside those. So about 25 years ago, we didn't really have that information. We did have things called T Tauri stars, which are very... The Sun was once a T Tauri star, and they are very active, are very energetic, and very convective surfaces. And in fact, there's an artist's impression. I think the artist got a bit carried away of how it looks like a very disturbed ostrich. But anyway... losing its plumes. It certainly needs a shower. But what's happened there? There's a lot of energy inside these clouds. And I postulated in the early 70s that it was so much energy that not only would you see, you'd have gas pressure, which is that middle term, got it working, but you'd have this additional term here. I'll just bring it into focus. And that's the where I get into trouble, because it's this extra turbulent stress that I have in my theory, which is 100 times the gas pressure, and a lot of the other theorists are unhappy with that idea. And anyway, I think that's the thing that causes the cloud to shed discrete gas rings, and it blows the outer layers of the star up. They become very tenuous, and the clouds, the outer layer, the cloud actually becomes very centrally condensed. Most of its mass hugs near the centre, and the cloud is actually able to get rid of its angular momentum at the expense of losing very little mass, and in turn it creates planets which have very little mass. So the moment of inertia is sort of how close the bulk of the mass is to the centre of the cloud. And I think I put it out 25 years ago that if you included supersonic turbulent pressure, it would blow the star outer layers up, the star cloud would become very centrally condensed, and it would be able to shed very little mass in concordance with the... And this is an idea of these spinning wheels, and you also get a, what's called a turbulent viscosity. Now, I have actually, if Matthew's there, I've got a video in just a few microseconds, a little longer than that. Here's a... there, you also get a lid of non... opinion was that when he got as far as reading that I was using supersonic turbulence, he quit. I cannot conceive of any way this... it could even be modified. So it could be sent off to the Emu Gazette, possibly. And there's another one on the Jovian system. So as far as sort of, endorsement of the model, I probably can't claim that. To get around the problem, every now and then I make a prediction. And some of them actually have hit the mark, which is extraordinary. Jupiter and Uranus and Saturn and Jupiter's clouds. I'll come to that in a moment because we were talking about that. The clouds, gas rings, actually, they're quite interesting. They form a geometric sequence. And during when Ed Stone was project scientist, there were two flypasts, one of Uranus, one of Neptune, where we discovered previously unknown moons inside the orbit of Miranda. And I had predicted two moons or belts of moons at 3.5 and 2.5 Uranian radii. And in fact, they did find a moon called Puck, I think it was, at about 3.5. And there was a tribe of little smaller moons around 2.5. So there was some merit to that formula, and at Neptune was even more exciting because there's more carbon out there and you can't see very well even when it's focused. And in fact, there's a phantom planet that's been there all along, but down at the bottom is Neptune, which is really out of whack. I don't know what's going on there. And up there is Triton, but in between there should have been a family of four big moons. And that's Neptune, and this was published by Charles Morgan in Japan just before the Jovian, with the encounter with Neptune. I did predict that Voyager would find four new large moons around that planet, and it's starting at about 5 radii, 3.5, 2.5, and 1.8, and blow me down if about a month later four moons did show up, and very close to that position. So that was... one sort of triumph of the model that I don't think... certainly I don't think anyone repeated that one. So that's been a success in terms of the supersonic turbulence, in terms of the predictions. The chemistry of the solar system is another story. A feature of gas rings is they do have a focusing property, and one advantage of the gas ring model, that material that forms from a gas ring stays within that gas ring, and as you move from one orbit to another... And if the temperature varies from one orbit to another, each planet has its own chemical origin, and it's different from the others because each planet accretes at the same distance from the sun. And so you can have a sort of chemical gradation from one gas ring to another because there isn't any mixing from one to another. I had students demonstrate that the gas rings do have this focusing property. The moment you take away the gas, the stuff spreads out to get a disk, or like in Saturn's rings, and it becomes homogenized. As long as the gas ring is intact, it does focus the material, and each planet would reflect the formative temperatures. And the temperature varies through the system as one over the distance. The more distant planets form at lower temperatures, and therefore have a great preponderance of ice, and the inner planets are mostly rock. And the model is fully quantitative. I can calculate the temperatures at which the planets formed, like Mercury at 1630. At that temperature, it's so hot that principally iron is the only material that condenses. And as you get out into orbits of Venus and Earth, that's when the silicates can condense as well. John Lewis was the first to suggest this idea of chemical fractionation for the disk models. But it works very well for the gas ring models, and it does allow us to explain the remarkable differences or chemical gradations in these systems. And you can actually calculate the amount of difference of these materials that are in there, like Mercury being mostly iron. And, of course, the Magellan Project has shown that... I think Dave Crisp showed it's a very dry planet. There's hardly any water there, and that's because Venus formed about 950 Kelvin. It's just too hot for any even hydrated silicates. You've got to get out to the. That's a Magellan radar. You've got to get out to the Earth before you start to see any water. Not water from comets or anything like that, but it's water, I think, that came from the Earth's interior. And there are things, hydrated silicates, which will form at 700 Kelvin, like tremolite, and they do contain water, and there's enough water in that to actually account for the Earth's content of water. Ed Stone will be talking about Mars in another couple of nights, but I did point out here that the chemistry of the solar system that comes from this theory does seem to account well for the observed chemistry. You can see Jupiter just lurking in there, about to cause trouble, because I better wind up soon before I'm dragged away myself. And Bob has given a very fine overview of the Galileo project. That's the other testing laboratory for this modern Laplacian theory. Fortunately, I've been able to sort of... Bob was using even-numbered slides, and I'm using odd-numbered, so we're not overlapping so far. But here's the launch, and that one is an overlap. I must get hold of some of these extended mission slides. They look really good. This one is an artist's impression, showing the probe going in at that huge speed. And, of course, that's interesting because it shows the orbiter just up there picking up the signal, relaying back to Earth. And I remember the excitement that I think was it December the 7th, 1995? I remember, in fact, Bill O'Neill, I don't want to leave him out of the picture, he is giving a talk out at Monash, and I have some flyers for these public lectures, free of charge. Bill O'Neill, project manager of Primary Mission, will be lecturing out at Monash University on Wednesday. And, of course, a great wealth of information about the structure of the planet. The amount of sulfur was great interest to me, because it's a diagnostic of the... it's gone. But... I had predicted the sulfur content of the Jovian atmosphere to be 74 parts per million, that one. And the measured value was 77 plus or minus 5. It was in a JPL publication. Needless to say, this was sent to JGR and was shot down within minutes of arrival by the editorial staff. They've got a trained... I have sniffer dogs at the airports waiting for any of my publications. And of course, a great bounty of information. Bob's shown that. There's a core inside EO, a molten sulfur, a molten iron sulfide, and that John Anderson's team discovered that with the gravity measurements. And that iron sulfide comes from the model as well. It's work I published with Tahar in Nature and about 20 years ago. All of the Galilean moons have a great wad of iron sulfide, and that melts long before silicates and will trickle to the centre of moons like Io and Ganymede to form a great core. And there's a family sort of photo, but they're in order of size there, as we know Io is to the left of Europa. But each moon has got its own story to tell. And this 1 over R temperature law, which was in that red curve in the diagram, does seem to do the trick. It explains the internal structure. Some more recent measurements have suggested that there is some gravitational settling in Callisto, and that maybe it did have a shell of water, a bit like Europa, a shell of water maybe 250 kilometres thick at the time of its formation, probably from late bombardments. There's a lot of accretional energy, but I think today I would suggest that shell is totally frozen. We'll finish up here, and because I've probably gone over time, and I'll be never allowed to speak here at Science Works again, or anywhere. that's a very lousy picture of Europa, so we won't look at that. but I did predict that Europa would have a moment of inertia factor. This is a magnificent achievement here. In 1996, you can check, I predicted a moment of inertia factor of 0.347, and then Galileo found it to be the same, 0.347. That's just a two-zone model, a very simple one with a shell of ice at the surface, but it did seem to hold up well. I did predict a large magnetic field, and as far as I'm aware, that hasn't materialized. But there will be another opportunity, I think, in November to look for a magnetic field. And so what we can say in conclusion is that I think Bob Mitchell pointed out that the Galilean system really is like a miniature solar system. And what's intriguing is this fairly controversial theory I have for how these systems formed. Well, although people are unhappy with the supersonic turbulence, it does provide a mechanism for accounting for the physical properties of these systems that this is not too far from what is observed, and the theory is able to make predictions. So we could conclude that almost certainly we're not alone, and that there, right throughout the universe, it must be bristling with planetary systems just like ours. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.